and we'll wait till everyone. This is case 033622, Barrow versus Uchtman. And Ronald. Mr. Cavise.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Court. I represent Ronald Barrow, the petitioner, and the appellate in this case. In the time that's allotted to me, it's difficult to assess which prong of the Strickland argument to focus upon. I think the first prong, that is to say the general level of professional competence, was set forth in a fairly straightforward manner in the briefs. There were a number of very serious errors that were made. I will single out just two of them.
But could I ask you, though, I mean, honestly, it's a short amount of time. And I'll tell you right up front, what worries me is the prejudice prong, because we have this taped conversation. Whatever you may think of Mr. Rona, whatever, I mean, you know, other things can come in later, but in this taped conversation, Mr. Barrow himself refers to a great number of things that correspond to this murder. A basement, stairs, sawhorses, the location, so many things. And if out of his own mouth have come these kinds of comments, and then we go back and think about the fact that even very unsavory characters can be believed by juries, including people like Mr. Rona, etc. It's the prejudice part that bothers me, even if we assume that this lawyer failed the performance part.
Thank you, Your Honor, for guiding the discussion. We let me tell you just a bit about what the defense would have been.
Yeah, because that also actually was a big concern of mine. I felt very dissatisfied of thinking, how can I imagine this trial the way it ought to have been? And Mr. Barrow has not given us an affidavit to tell us the details of his alibi, the details of, you know, where he would have been, who could have testified, if anyone other than himself.
And that's, we really don't have that much to work with.
But Mr. Barrow you have to work with?
Well, he has an affidavit that he submitted in connection with his post-conviction petition, and that affidavit is mainly what I'm working from. Ever since that time, no court has ever allowed him to testify at any sort of evidentiary hearing, including the district court here.
And Professor Cavise, while you are going through all of that, would you be so kind as to tell us what Bruce Barrow's testimony would have been had he been called to testify?
Absolutely, Your Honor. All right, so first then, we have, working mainly from this affidavit that we have from him, and confining my comments strictly to those that are a matter of present record, Mr. Barrow would have testified, first of all, that he had nothing to do with the Oberto murder. That's the murder in question. He would have testified further as to a reasonable theory of innocence, that in fact he was in the area that week. There is no contest to that aspect of the state's case. The state makes it sound as though there was a tremendous amount of circumstantial evidence, much of which Ronald Barrow would never have contested. He was in the area. He spoke to Judy Heron, the star witness's girlfriend. He was, you know, he visited her twice. At one point during the week, his brother was stopped by the police, etc., etc. All of that would have been absolutely uncontested evidence. Then coming to the audio tape, let me just say.
I don't remember that his affidavit said anything like, you know, I went to my friend so and so's house that night and was there, you know, all night or anything.
No, in a sense.
It's very odd because he does know where he was.
That's
he
right.
was competent to testify to
He was, but in that. In that paper affidavit, mind you, this is not testimony.
But it's a proffer.
I mean, it is a proffer.
To get
That's right.
To the next base.
It's not sufficiently detailed. And let me just tell you what I think is the detail that we have to work with. He was auditioning to be a crime partner with Smokey Rona. And even Smokey Rona testified to this. Sent him to Iowa, apparently, to pick up a suitcase, come back to LaSalle County to deliver the suitcase. That is also the case. There were two jobs, apparently, that the star witness, Smokey Rona, sent him on. In the audio tape to which Your Honor is referring, in the audio tape, Ronald Barrow is talking about different criminality.
Well, I know that's what he now says, which sounds a bit different from what he was saying before the Illinois court, but A, he doesn't give us any details about that, and again, you know, we have this, everything went as planned, they hit the man, use a 9mm gun, the basement was searched, you know, this business about the steps, pulled up the first two steps, I mean, it just, without saying, well, you know, I was going to rob a house, you know, here's the other unsolved murder. I realize there are Fifth mm-hmm. Amendment aspects to that, although he doesn't seem to be saying anything about that.
Can I just
hang together?
Well, how it hangs together is first of all, you know, it's obvious that the criminality that Mr. Barrow is talking about in the tape is serious criminality. But we have to focus on distinctions that are important between the audio tape and the evidence in this case and the evidence as the star witness testified to it. For example, the first thing that, by the way, let me just say parenthetically, he's not saying something different. His story has been consistent ever since I saw the affidavit. He's not saying something different than he said on direct appeal, and that's part of the unreasonableness, if you will, of the state Supreme Court, which I feel that they created, basically, a defense that wasn't there, something having to do with braggadocio, etc. And I can trace that back for you, Your Honor, if we have the time.
But
when he gets to the audio tape, one of the first things he says is that I whipped, that's his word, I whipped this person all over. That he's talking about. Well, in the case at hand, it was quite clear there wasn't a mark on the person's body who's the victim of the case, aside from the one gunshot wound. At various times, Smokey Rona, who, by the way, is doing most of the talking and by way of leading questions, I might add, he says, "How about the barrels of coins?" To which Barrow says, "I didn't see any barrels." "How about the cans, you know, of the coffee cans where he kept coins?" To which Barrow says, "I didn't see any coffee cans." He says, "How about the three slot machines?" To which Barrow says, "There was just garbage and whatnot." On the steps, Barrow says the steps were brand new. The evidence is that they were old and stained. Now, I realize that may sound like here we have two crimes that involve steps in a basement. That's what the jury consideration is most likely going to focus on here. And you know, the inconsistencies between the audio tape and what Mr. Barrow would say, you know, on a remand, or the inconsistencies even between the audio tape and what Mr. Rona said on, were never explored by counsel.
You know, Professor Covey's, the biggest hole for me is the fact that his attorney kept Barrow off the stand and yet allowed, by either failing to object or to file any sorts of motions in limine, Barrow's entire criminal history to infect the jury on many, many, many occasions.
Not only allowed it, Your Honor, in opening statement, he mentioned it himself. In opening statement, he said, "Mr. Barrow has prior convictions." And then when the audio tape came out and when the state's evidence came out, he absolutely never said a word. This is a person, I'm talking about defense counsel now, who obviously does not understand the effect that credibility, the effect on credibility of prior convictions. And this is a person who asked not one single question of the star witness about his prior convictions when he himself said he had two. Before the grand jury, he said he had four. The affidavit attached to post-conviction says he has nine. The Illinois appellate court says he's a habitual offender. Seven people asked to be excused from the jury because they said they couldn't believe a word he said. And he asked not one single question on cross-examination about any prior convictions. And just to dot the I in that, Your Honor, he asked eight jurors to give Smokey Rona the same credibility that they would give to any other witness, something which, if the prosecution had said that, would have been immediately objected to. So Your Honor refers to that as a whole. I find that to be a startling ignorance of the law, quoting Kimmelman on that particular point. And that's I see that I'm into my rebuttal time.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Huffman, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel. Your Honor, I am Assistant Attorney General Jay Huffman. In this case, I represent the respondent, Warden. Let me start with the last thing that Mr. Cavies said and totally disagree with it. And I think I've debunked this in the brief. It surprises me that he mentioned it here. Counsel never said give Rona the credibility you would give anyone. Absolutely not. I went through all the areas he cites in his brief, and that's not what he said. Counsel drew a strong distinction and indeed objected to the people's comments in voir dire, where the people seemed to indicate that Mr. Rona should have the same credibility. What counsel said was the accurate description of the law, which is that everybody's judged by the same standards. You judge this guy by the standards, but, and this was the objection when the people talked about this, you don't give a convicted felon the same credibility. That's I can't believe I heard that this morning because that's absolutely untrue. With regard to the other matters, he did not impeach Mr. Rona specifically with his convictions. He did not impeach Mr. Rona specifically with the inconsistencies, and there are inconsistencies between what Mr. Rona said Beryl told him and between what was said on the tape and the evidence of the crime.
But let me just jump to the main point here, I think, because there are so many things that this lawyer did shockingly wrongly. And in light of that, the best you have for you is this taped conversation in terms of the prejudice argument that you make. The state court seemed basically to move to the prejudice angle as well. I mean, I think not very many people wanted to go to bat for this lawyer. And yet, when that much is going wrong, why doesn't that, to use the legal standard, undermine your confidence in the integrity of the proceeding that led to this guilty verdict? Why isn't that enough? It doesn't have to be a 51% probability of a different result. It just has to undermine your confidence in the integrity of the proceeding. And mine is shaken with this many mistakes, I'll tell you. Maybe not undermined yet, but I'm interested in what you have to say.
Before going on, Your Honor, I disagree with the analysis in the Illinois Supreme Court, at least to the issue of this matter of raising an issue and having it waived, never said that counsel was wrong. It's a very fine area of the law, and it's unclear whether
they more or less did, though. They go on, and they have a parenthetical after it. I've read their opinions, and I don't think they in any way are defending what counsel did as a matter of a sound approach to Illinois law.
Well, they never said he misunderstood it, and they found in addition...
You're being picky.
I'll go on.
If you'd like, I'll look up what they actually said, but I just think it's a waste of time.
They also found that, given that matter, even assuming, I believe is what they said, that he was wrong on this issue of what was waived and what was not waived, that this wasn't his sole decision, and therefore he made a reasonable decision not to present evidence. And I think that's the main issue here, whether he was right or wrong. And looking at what it could have been presented, Mr. Beryl has never told us exactly what the crime is. And going to the matter of the prejudice, if you look at the fact that Mr. Beryl never said, I was delivering this suitcase, I was committing a crime in another state. Well, then, if he was committing a crime in another state, why is it that he was seen by a police officer coming from an area immediately after this crime?
He has an explanation for that, of course.
He's always admitted that. You see, the state has argued that the evidence against Barrow is overwhelming. But let's suppose for a moment that Mr. Barrow would have been able to put on a defense that successfully convinced the jurors that it was all a setup by Rona. Now, of course, that's his thesis, that it was all a setup by Rona. Because once we wipe out all the evidence tainted by Rona and Rona's girlfriend, including the tape-recorded conversation, it doesn't leave much compelling evidence, does it? In other words, a successful a successful defense regarding a setup by Rona might have been likely to alter the outcome of this case.
Respondent disagrees, Your Honor. Respondent believes that the Illinois Supreme Court was correct and that the district court here was correct when it determined that the Supreme Court made a reasonable determination. You have to take an indeed. Rona's girlfriend is tainted by the fact that it's Rona's girlfriend. Rona's tainted by the fact that he got a deal. But there is all this evidence that he was in the area, and not just the fact that he was in the area for a certain amount of time, but he was in that area for a week prior to the crime, and then there's the circumstantial evidence that even if you explain this business about, oh, well, I made a U-turn, and that's why the police officer saw me when he thought I could only go. Immediately after this crime, this night, he's seen speeding back to the East Coast and caught in Indiana, and he tells Rona, boy, were we lucky. I had just gotten rid of that gun. I couldn't believe we were lucky. I think that what you have here is an overwhelming circumstantial case which is absolutely tied together. The ends are tied together very tightly by his comments. Yes, he never mentions Cedar Point in the taped interview. He never mentioned some other things. But as Your Honor pointed out initially, there are so many things in there that are pointed out and that tie the ends of this so that there can be no doubt that this is the crime. He says, well, it's a different crime in another state. Well, what state? Immediately after this crime, he's hightailing it back to the East Coast.
Well, look, if in fact Rona knew who committed the crime but set Barrow up in exchange for a release from prison, that's a pretty big gift, that release from prison, then here's what's tainted. Tainted at best and entirely false at worst. Rona's testimony regarding Barrow's confession, including Rona's testimony that Barrow used a 9mm gun. The testimony of Rona's girlfriend, Judy Heron. She's got a lot to gain here. Although what you want with Rona, I'm not sure. And the tape-recorded, conversation between Rona and Barrow. And that's kind of it. And you have left such weak evidence pointing,
Is your honor finished?
I
would disagree that it's weak evidence. Certainly, again, as Judge Wood indicated, a jury is entitled to believe even a career criminal and a career criminal's girlfriend. You have all the circumstantial evidence, some of which he admits, some of which he doesn't necessarily admit, but goes to the fact that he was in this particular area, not some other state, and you have the fact that all these things are tied together by the statements. You can say, well, Rona says he used a 9mm. Barrow mentioned the 9mm in his in the taped statement. Barrow mentions pulling
up
steps.
Mr. Hoffman, is the original of that tape in the record that made it to this court? I've seen lots of characterizations of what's been said on it, but to be honest, I haven't listened to it myself, and I don't know if it's here.
I've never heard the tape. It was read into the record, Your Honor.
Was there ever any consideration here given to analyzing these facts under Chronic rather than Strickland?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe there was.
Are you acquainted with a Chronic, United States versus Chronic?
Yes. Yeah, for Chronic, Your Honor.
That doesn't require any showing of prejudice.
No, but for Chronic, there has to be an absolute abandonment of all defense. And there clearly wasn't here, which brings up another point. With regard to some of the things that counsel says should have been impeached or should have been argued, it's true that some of that impeachment or some contrary evidence wasn't put on, but this was a tactic by the attorney at trial here. He said he believed, I didn't believe that I had evidence that even one person, that I could change the mind of even one juror. And he said specifically in the post-trial motion hearing, if I believed that, if I thought that I had the evidence that even could convince one person, I would have put it on. He went out to Maryland to interview Bruce Barrow. And came back, and he said, I interviewed this guy. I don't think he was a good witness.
There was evidence he wanted to go on vacation with his family. I mean, he may have just been in the wrong line of business to be doing criminal defense work, to give up on a client that easily.
And look at how terrific a witness Bruce was for himself. He's acquitted.
He's acquitted of perjury, Your Honor. We don't know what that crime was. And counsel in his post-trial motion testimony said, you know, the evidence I had was that he was innocent of that trial. And we don't know what his testimony was like there. We don't know what the evidence was. To judge the fact that he's acquitted in that case to say that, oh, well, we had to present him here, I think is inappropriate, Your Honor. I see that my time is up. We would ask that this court affirm the judgment below of the district court, which dismissed the habeas petition. Thank you, Your Honor.
Do you want another minute, Mr. Hoffman, if there's something more you wanted to say?
No, I just reiterate that if you really look at the record here, you see that while counsel made some decisions that present counsel doesn't like, counsel did not abandon this. Perhaps he wanted to get out of criminal law. Perhaps he wanted to go on vacation. But that doesn't change what he did in this case. And what he did here was very reasonable. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Now, by way of a brief rebuttal, I would cite the court to page 20 of my initial brief, where I talk about the 8 times that he mentioned prior convictions. And reviewing it over the weekend, I went through it again, and at least 3 of them are directly in reference to Smokey Rona. So I wanted to respond to counsel's point there. I also wanted to say that I didn't argue a Kronik, Your Honor, simply because the circuit has been fairly restrictive in their application of Kronik and very, very limited in Kronik's application to cases like this. I certainly think there was a failure of counsel in this case, and I would love to have argued Kronik and made that choice, and perhaps it was the wrong choice. I would simply reaffirm, as this court said just a couple of weeks ago in the Owens decision, I think, Judge Ward, you were on that panel, that all this court needs to find is that there's an appreciable chance that a jury is going to see the same contradictions that I have seen, at least, and that they will see the contradictions in the case, and that once and for all, finally, that Ronald Burrow will have a chance to tell his story in court. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Now, Professor Cavis, you were appointed, weren't you?
Yes, I was, Your Honor.
Well, you certainly have the deep thanks of this court for your hard work on behalf of your client.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Of course, the Attorney General's office has the thanks of the court for always coming in here and helping us out. So thanks to both parties.